22-1097 Graydon v. Spring Creek Energy.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John Krisham on behalf of the plaintiff, Kimberly Graydon. In the lead-up to the sale that led to this lawsuit, Ms. Graydon told the defendants repeatedly that she had no interest in selling overriding royalty interests that were connected to producing oil and gas wells. She told them this over the phone, she said this in emails, and she swore out a declaration in the district court confirming both of those things. Despite those repeated statements, the defendants knowingly misled Ms. Graydon into believing that the interest she was ultimately going to sell were not connected to producing wells, even though they knew that there were producing wells on the land. As a matter of Colorado law, the defendants had a duty to disclose the existence of these wells prior to the sale, and Ms. Graydon is entitled to a jury trial to determine whether or not the defendants breached that duty. Now, the district court granted summary judgment on a different theory, which is that Ms. Graydon's claims are barred by constructive notice by the virtue of the fact that certain documents had been recorded with the Weld County Clerk and Recorder's Office.
Now, are you challenging the legal theory? That legal theory is contrary to the great weight of authority, but that seems to be what the Colorado Supreme Court said in Vinton, that a defense to a fraud claim is constructive notice through the recording statutes, that provides a defense. Are you challenging that theory? I didn't see that in the brief.
No, our arguments are those set forth in the brief, which is this sort of document does not give rise to, does not affect title in such a way that notice is provided. And then
so you're saying as a matter of Colorado law, these documents do not provide constructive notice.
That's correct. And that's because there's several Colorado Supreme Court decisions on this, but one of which is the Berger case, which is 795 P. Second, 1380. And that is one of the many cases in which the Supreme Court has adopted the second restatement of torts, section 551, subsection 2, which provides that fraudulent concealment and fraud-based and misrepresentation-based claims can proceed notwithstanding the fact that, notwithstanding the fact that there is some document out there.
Wait. See, that's what I asked about to start with. That would be a very good argument everywhere but Colorado. How do you deal with
that? Well, that was our argument. That was our argument before the magistrate judge. And then the defendants came up with this new constructive notice theory.
Well, they didn't come up with it. The Colorado Supreme Court came up with it.
Fair enough. But they raised it for the first time after the report and recommendation was issued. Okay. And so then we addressed that argument on its terms, after which the district court granted summary judgment solely on notice grounds.
So, but in this court, you're not challenging that Vinton says that there is a defense to a claim of fraud if there are documents recorded under the statutes that comply with the statutory requirements that under the statute provide constructive notice. So even though she had no idea about these documents, but as a matter of law, they provided constructive notice. And under Vinton, the fact that
Vinton, what is the case that you're referring to, Your Honor?
I'm probably misstating it. Yeah, Vinton. Vinton versus Verzi.
Okay.
269 Pacific, Reporter 3rd, 1242.
Okay.
And I didn't think you said anything in your brief contrary to that, but I thought your oral argument was going in a direction that was contrary
to
Vinton. And I thought maybe you're saying I'm wrong about what Vinton means, or it's been set aside or something like that.
I confess I'm not aware of this Vinton case. I don't believe it was briefed or cited in the briefs in this case. Maybe I'm misunderstanding or misremembering that. But our position is a fraudulent concealment claim can proceed, notwithstanding, like it's not a defense to a fraudulent concealment claim to say that the plaintiff or whoever the party is alleging they were defrauded could have looked at some source or, you know, for information that would have told them the truth that would unveil the defendant's fraudulent statements. And there's a long line of cases that hold that. We've cited those in the second half of both of our briefs, going as far back as 1875 in the Seller versus Cleland case from the Colorado Supreme Court, and then continuing through the decades up into the 1960s. That is our position on the common law sort of piece of this. But we also think these sorts of documents that the defendants are pointing to don't even suffice to give notice under the statute itself, because the statute is very clear that not any and all written instrument that is recorded provides notice. It's any written instrument that is recorded in its affecting title to real property. The documents that were submitted to the district court by the defendants in this case do not affect title to real property. There are two categories of documents. And frankly, I think in the red brief, it seems like only one of those categories is still being raised by the defendants. But the two types of documents are what are called affidavits of extension and pooling declarations. Affidavits of extension are things whereby an oil and gas operator, a lessee, is claiming an extension to the term of the lease. But that does not affect title to anything.
Well, even then, they have to be filed within 6 months of the...
That's correct.
And this was just decades later, wasn't it?
Yes, it was several decades later. So under the terms of the statute, it provides that an affidavit of extension should be filed within 6 months of the expiration of the primary term of the lease. These leases were from 1970 and 1971. So therefore, any affidavit of extension connected to this land from 1975 or 1976 onwards is, in our position, is effectively a nullity, but it certainly doesn't extend the term of the lease. What extends the terms of lease are the lease itself, what it says in there, and secondly, actual facts on the ground, if there is, in fact, ongoing production. And that's a little bit nuanced under Colorado law, because production doesn't necessarily mean extraction and sales of oil and gas. Colorado is a commercial discovery rule state, which means that production means either in fact producing or capable of producing. So you need to go and look and see whether in fact an operator is in fact producing oil and gas in commercially viable quantities, or whether that oil and gas rig is capable of doing so.
What about the pooling?
Pooling declarations are simply, again, these are historical, a pooling declaration is a statement that in the past, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has pooled or grouped certain tracts of land together into a single drilling unit. That's all it is. It does not affect anyone's title. It just takes multiple tracts of land.
What about unitization?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What about unitization? It's pooling or unitization. I thought there were alternatives. And one, I thought in this case, the parties, the various leaseholders, agreed, and the lessee and lessors, agreed that production on one unit would preserve the rights for the entire area.
Correct.
Okay, that's a change in their property rights, is it not?
No, I don't. But maybe as it pertains to the lessor and the lessee, but not to an overriding royalty interest owner, because they're not a party to the lease, and so it does not affect their ownership interest under the separate instrument.
But the statute provides constructive notice of documents that affect title, and if the unitization agreement affects title, then it provides constructive notice.
That has never been argued by the defendants, Your Honor. What they argued is that affidavits of extension, this is what they sought judicial notice of in the district court, that affidavits of extension and pooling declarations, those are the type of documents and those are the arguments that they raised.
But and they just referred to pooling documents.
Correct.
It's not unitization.
Correct. And I think you'll search the red brief in vain for any reference to either pooling declarations or unitization.
They just relied on the affidavit.
Correct, Your Honor. Now, I said that the text of the statute makes clear that constructive notice does not go out to all the world anytime a written instrument is recorded because it has to also affect title. It's a standard methodology in statutory interpretation that when a statute does not define a term, we look to its ordinary meaning, which often is aided by contemporaneous dictionary definitions. If we look at the contemporaneous dictionary definitions in effect when the Recording Act was first enacted in Colorado back in 1870, I believe, those make clear, as we would probably understand, that effect means to change or act upon. And we submit that when the legislature put that language in that statute, it intended it to mean what it ordinarily means. And I think that we also know that that's the case, because the larger statutory structure, the provisions that follow 3835.106, those include similar limiting language, including conveyance, encumbrance, or effect title to real property. We think these are basic and cardinal principles of statutory construction, that we need to apply terms that are used together by a legislature as though they have a common core of meaning. And when I think those terms, when they're used together in those other provisions of this recording statutory scheme, it's clear that the documents at issue have to, in fact, do something to the underlying title.
Counsel, apart from your effects title and the property argument, are you also contending that the recording statute provides constructive notice to subsequent purchasers, and not someone in Ms. Graydon's position?
That our argument is that it was intended to provide those subsequent purchasers with notice and the ability to rely on record title at the time that they're looking to become a purchaser.
It's right. That's a separate argument, isn't it, from your affecting title?
Yes, it's not a strict textualist argument, I don't think, or textual.
Well, I don't know how it
argument.
Can be. I mean, the text says shall be noticed to all persons claiming any interest in said property. So on the face of it, it doesn't seem to work. And that's why I'd like you to address why you're making that argument.
Sure. We're making that argument for two reasons. First, the Colorado Supreme Court has recognized this time and again. We cite the Upson case, and then there's a Colorado Court of Appeals case that follows after that. I'm blanking on the name, but they're in our briefing. And what they make clear is applying the recording statute to a person like Ms. Graydon is not what the statute was intended to achieve. And we also know that because the legislature told us that. If we look at 3834.101 of the statute, it makes clear that the intent and purpose of the Colorado Recording Act is to protect prior in time subsequent purchasers and to allow them to rely on title and to ensure that one, like Ms. Graydon, who already has an ownership interest, is her interests aren't defeated by technical or strict constructions. So we think both there's a line of authority from the Colorado appellate courts and the statutory purpose that is expressed by the legislature itself, those things together are why it's our position that this statute was aimed to actually help subsequent purchasers, not penalize those who own for many years beforehand. The last point I want to make, and I think this is important, is that irrespective of the statutory arguments, there, and I mentioned this earlier, but there is a long and unbroken line of case law from the Colorado Supreme Court holding that claims just like this can proceed, notwithstanding the fact that there is information out there in the public domain that the plaintiff could have tried to learn but didn't. Because the rationale underlying those cases is we do not penalize people who have been defrauded for relying on representations that are made to them. We allow those individuals to get in front of a jury and have their case heard. And we submit that that is this case, too.
Did the district court take the opposite position on that question, or are you making an argument that for us would be actually an alternative ground to reverse?
No, it was passed on below, Your Honor. We raised it below. It was briefed. The court ruled on it. What the court held was that those cases were inapplicable in its view because they didn't address the Recording Act itself. And we believe that doesn't change the fact that in this court's decision in the Markenthal case from last year, which I recognize was under Utah law, but it recognized the same thing, which is that fraud-based claims can go forward notwithstanding the fact or an argument that the plaintiff should have been on notice or constructive notice in that case and here. So the point is it's a longstanding common law doctrine that these claims can proceed. I realize I'm out of time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Culhane. I represent Spring Creek Energy Partners and Jason Eddington. With me is Christopher Hayes, my co-counsel. In this case, the plaintiff claims that the defendants fraudulently concealed public documents from her. This is impossible, both as a matter of law
and
a matter of...
She didn't say that. She didn't say the fraud was not telling me about these documents. She said the fraud was telling me that these properties weren't producing.
And the public record, which Colorado law recognizes and which Vinson is dispositive on, says that there can't be fraud where there is a validly recorded document providing the information that is at issue in this case.
Did you cite Vinson?
I didn't cite Vinson. There are a number of other cases, Franklin versus Bowling. There is In Re Potts. There is Arno versus First Federal Savings and Loan, Bollinger versus Neal. All of these cases hold the same thing. But Your Honor, that's what this case comes down to. All of the Supreme Court has been perfectly clear about this. The Colorado Supreme Court has been clear about this. And what the defendants are trying to do is create a new interpretation that's completely novel in this jurisdiction and any other, where some recorded documents don't provide constructive notice, but other recorded documents do.
Okay, and here you're relying on the statement that if the document affects title, then it provides constructive notice. Is that right?
That's what the plaintiff is urging. But we think that this is a cramped and inappropriately narrow reading of the word affect title.
Well, do you agree that the issue is whether it affects title?
No.
Under your reading. Well, so you don't care whether it's a narrow reading or not?
Are you saying that
these documents affect the title?
Yes.
Or are you saying that it's not necessary that they affect title to provide constructive notice?
So let me break that into two parts.
Yes.
First of all, these documents do affect title.
Okay. Then your second part is?
And the second part is, properly interpreted, the word affect title means the breadth of title, including providing notice about the status of title. So let me give you some examples. A notice of list pendants clearly affects the title, even though a list pendants itself doesn't determine the outcome of the litigation that it's providing notice about. It doesn't affect the ultimate disposition of that case, but it absolutely affects the title because it gives everybody notice.
Okay, so let's take the affidavits then.
Yes.
Tell me how they affect title.
So under Colorado Revised Statute 38-42-106, sub 1, This is in the oil and gas section of Title 38. It requires an operator to record an affidavit of extension of lease by production. If the operator fails to do that, it will negate the notice provided by the original recorded lease. Okay. And it means that that lease is no longer has the protection of
the... So it can affect title.
Absolutely.
But it has to be filed within 6 months.
Well, there's no allegation in this case that somehow these documents are incorrect or they were improperly filed or they're...
Yes, there is. I thought he just argued, maybe it's not in the brief, but the statute requires these affidavits to be filed within 6 months of the expiration of the original lease. You agree with that?
That's what the statute says, yes.
And these were filed a couple decades later, were they not?
We didn't go all the way back to the beginning of, you know, to the
1970s. But from the record, you haven't established that there's anything filed that affected title.
Well, the declarations of pooling and unitization do the same thing.
Where did you argue that in your responsive brief in this court?
We cited the grant of judicial notice of the entire set of documents, and we rely on...
Cited where? I've got your brief in front of me. I looked for the word unit, and it appears only in the word United and United States. I looked for the word pool, and it appears once. Where did you argue that the declarations of pooling or unitization affected title?
We submitted all of those...
In your brief on appeal, that's when...
I don't believe we specifically referenced those particular documents, but the intention wasn't to exclude one set versus the other. We rely on the entire recorded history.
Don't you have to say that in your brief to us in response to their arguments?
Your Honor, we believe that the court took judicial notice of those records. It's part of the record, and it's part of our argument. It's always been our argument that the entire sequence of documents that have been recorded provide...
Does the record contain the sequence of affidavits extending the initial lease?
I am unsure of how far it goes back. I'm happy to pause and look in the record.
We'll leave that aside.
Okay.
Then does the declaration of unitization or declaration of pooling, that does not give notice of anything except what's stated in that declaration, which is these properties are being pooled or they're part of a unit, right?
Correct.
Well, that can happen without there being any production. So how does that declaration provide notice of production on the lease?
Because the unitization with these particular leases, these declarations which are recorded, indicate that the pooled interest represents a continuing operation of the existing production under those leases.
Well, Mike put you on inquiry notice, but you haven't argued inquiry notice. You've argued constructive notice. And constructive notice is what the document says, not what you could find out if you looked at the document and conducted an investigation. And those documents do not show production. They don't state that there is production. They don't have to say that there is production. They just say if there is production, that's enough. It's enough to protect the entire lease, when there's production on one of the leases. But it doesn't say there is production.
Well, so, Your Honor, we believe that, and we have argued, that all of these documents taken together put Ms. Graydon on notice explicitly that there is ongoing production on her leases that are affected by this sale. And that's what we argued to the trial court, and the trial court agreed, and the trial court granted the request for judicial notice and accepted those documents and found that they put Ms. Graydon on constructive notice of continuing production on her lease. And we believe that that's exactly what happened here. What the defendants are arguing is something different. They're arguing that affidavits of extension of lease in general fail to provide constructive notice. That's their argument, because what they're saying is that affidavit does not affect the title in the sense of convey real estate interests or encumber real estate interests. And so what they want this court to find is that the Recording Act only applies to a subset of the recorded documents by adopting an inappropriately narrow definition of the word effect.
Could you give us your definition of effect title, and what is your support for that definition?
My definition of effect title is has an impact on title. And I can point to, in fact, the dictionary definitions that the defendants cite. What they do in their definitions is they give a complete definition, but then they ignore the part that doesn't help them. And they focus on the words change. But those definitions that they give are broader than that. And the word effect...
Well, so is this a debate over dictionaries then, or is there something else you're relying upon besides your preferred reading of a dictionary?
No, Your Honor. We're relying on several things. Most importantly, that no court has ever made the distinction that they're attempting to make here. And no court has ever entertained the notion that some documents provide notice in the record and some don't. And what you need to do is parse through what that document says to determine whether it puts you on notice or not. So this is a novel interpretation. It's never been even taken up by any court.
How far would you go, though, with your broader definition? Does that mean that anything that gets filed in the public record system counts as affecting title?
Well, no, because there are some cases, like fraudulent documents, which courts have held do not provide constructive notice. So a forged deed, there have been a couple of cases like that were briefed, which involve fraudulent circumstances. And so, no, you can't protect yourself from fraud by relying on the Recording Act when you're the person who's introduced that fraudulent statement into the record.
And I take it it's your position that the records put everyone on notice.
Yes,
Your
Honor.
Not just subsequent purchasers.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Graydon, Spring Creek is on notice too, right?
Everybody.
Spring Creek would be on notice from the records that these were producing wells, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet Spring Creek told Ms. Graydon that they weren't.
That's their allegation. But that's not what happened here. That's the allegation. But the Recording Act protects...
Well, but at this point, given what happened in district court, don't we have to... We don't have to accept that, I take it, from what you're saying.
Well, for purposes of summary judgment, the court accepted that statement as true.
And for purposes of summary judgment,
yes.
Doesn't this court have to accept
yes,
that?
Yes, it does.
So, back to my question, Spring Creek's on notice that the wells are producing, Ms. Graydon, according to you, is on notice, and yet you tell her that they weren't.
So, Your Honor, that goes back to the very first thing I said, which is that the plaintiff here is claiming that Mr. Eddington deceived her about a matter of public record, and that is impossible as a matter of law because of the Recording Act and because of the way the Colorado Supreme Court has interpreted.
All right, I'm just saying, but factually, now that we have the summary judgment, that is what happened.
That's the standard, yes. Right. I'm not arguing about the summary judgment standard, Your Honor. So, I'd like to just conclude with this. Suppose the law in Colorado was that only some recorded documents provide constructive notice the way the defendants are urging now, and that the notice is only deemed effective on prospective purchasers. And suppose that the Colorado legislature wanted to enact new legislation to fix that problem so that notice was imposed on everybody and that it was all of the documents. How would the Colorado Assembly go about that? We submit they would adopt the exact statute that's at issue here. It says that all written records, all written instruments affecting title to real property, whether noticed or not, notarized or not, provide notice to all persons and all classes of persons.
They might, instead of affecting title, they might say respecting title.
Yeah.
No, that's not a trivial difference because that's what would dispose of the argument made by the defendants in this case.
Let me just very briefly respond to that. In an adjoining section, the legislature uses the words conveying, encumbering, or affecting title. There is no purpose in stringing on an additional word affecting unless it means something different than conveying and encumbering. So I think affecting does mean respecting. That's what the legislature thinks it means, and that's why they use this broad word in the statute itself rather than conveying or encumbering. Thank you, Your Honor.
Did the appellant reserve any time? Thank you. Your time has expired. Case is submitted.